Diane. Great to be back with you for the first podcast of 2019. On my mind, the new year is starting much as it ended, with the government shutdown over President Trump's demand for a wall at the border. And it appears there's no compromise in sight as Trump doubles down on his campaign promise and Democrats stand firm in their opposition. So why is the president holding government hostage over this issue? One answer lies with evangelical voters. To understand why, I turn to Robert P. Jones, author of the book, The End of White Christian America. He's also CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Robbie, it's good of you to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we look ahead, let's look back at just how important the evangelical vote was to Donald Trump's election to the presidency in 2016 and the change or changes which may have occurred in the 2018 midterms.
Well, white evangelical Protestants are vitally important to Republican politics. They make up about 26% of voters, according to the exit polls, and they have maintained that for about 20 years. They've been about 26% of voters, and they voted 8 in 10 for Donald Trump in 2016 and about that level for Republican candidates in the 2018 midterm elections.
So any indication that that evangelical support is falling off is not so?
Not so much. We've been tracking white evangelical support for Trump really before the 2016 election all the way through. And basically what we see happening in the numbers is that as Trump's ascended to be the nominee and then the president, white evangelical support for him has actually crept up and kept going up. But since his inauguration, white evangelical support for President Trump has been somewhere between about two-thirds and three-quarters, which is extraordinarily high because in the general population, his favorability is only about 4 in 10.
So tell me why evangelical support is so strong for Trump.
Well, it's a little bit of a paradox, given that this is a group that had styled itself as so-called values voters in the 2004 election when they were supporting President Bush and had kind of opposed President Clinton on these very, issues and talked about themselves as values voters in the wake of the Clinton presidency. So it is a little ironic that they are this supportive of President Trump with his profile. So it's a complex thing. I think the first thing to say is that white evangelicals have been solid Republican constituencies really since the Civil Rights Movement. That's when most evangelicals moved from being Democrats, actually, to Republicans in the wake of the Democratic Party being associated as the party of civil rights. So they became Republicans really with Reagan and have stayed at that level ever since. So partisanship is a big part of the story. But the other part of the story, I think, here is that President Trump really appealed to a sense that the country is changing in ways that white evangelicals have found very uncomfortable and disconcerting. Such as, his build the wall that's in the news all the time now, I think, is a big piece of this. And his slogan, make America great again, right? It's that last word, I think, that has the power in that slogan. It's turning back the clock to a time when white evangelicals were more the majority of the population and had more cultural and political cachet and power.
So that's what they're counting on Trump to do for them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we've asked questions like, do you think American culture and way of life has changed for the better or changed for the worse since the 1950s, for example? On that question, there's virtually no other demographic group that thinks things have changed for the worst more than white evangelical Protestants. Three-quarters of them say things have changed for the worse since the 1950s.
So am I wrong in assuming that many evangelical voters who are in the upper age group, say 50s, 60s, 70s, are they at all different from the younger evangelicals who may have gone to college, who may have had exposure to other ideas, perhaps even more liberal thought?
you know, this is a question I've done a lot of thinking about and research on. What's interesting about the group of white evangelicals is that over the last decade, they have been shrinking as a proportion of the population. So a decade ago, they were 21% of the population. Today, they're only 15% of the population. Almost all of that loss has been from younger evangelicals. So it means the median age of evangelicals is going up. The median age today of white evangelical Protestants is 55. Only 8% are under the age of 30. So they've lost a big part of that cohort that might be pulling them back to more moderate positions because that generation tends to be more liberal on a whole host of issues. And it means that as the group has shrunk, it's also become more homogeneous, more supportive of President Trump.
And that support for President Trump includes that wall. And here we are on Monday afternoon with the government shut down with the president saying, well, maybe it won't be cement, it'll be steel, but we're going to have this wall. A couple of weeks ago, he seemed more malleable and then apparently heard from the likes of Sean Hannity and others who said, you have to stick to the wall. Why is that wall so important?
This is, I think, something really worth thinking about. I think many people are perplexed, like, okay, this is like one thing. Why are we shutting down the government over this one thing that may or may not be even be that effective by even measures among conservative organizations that are opposed to more immigration have said, like, this is not the most effective way, even if you have this goal. But I think what's important about it is the symbolism is very powerful. It's something very easy to visualize. It's something, if you're worried about changes in the country, it symbolizes a dam or holding back these changes to the country. And President Trump has been, you know, stoking these images of hordes of immigrants waiting at the border and only a wall will hold them back. I mean, those kinds of images have come a lot out of President Trump and the White House. And so if that's the image you're trying to project and you're talking to your base that is already worried about demographic changes in the country, cultural changes in the country, it's a fairly powerful image.
Are they worried about the loss of Christian dominance in this country?
You know, I think it's both. I think it's wrapped up. And I think this is important to remember that in American history, race and religion and whiteness and Christianity have, in particular, have always been interwoven. So even the Ku Klux Klan in the early part of the 20th century wasn't just about anti-black. They were also anti-Catholic, right? It was about protecting a white Protestant version of America. And that is the central kind of cultural center of gravity. And I think that's still with us today. And so we see that immigration and immigrants in particular, right, they're mostly non-white from Mexico is the focus of this particular wall. So there would be a, quote, browning of America is one way that this gets talked about in conservative media. And they're largely Catholic. They're not Protestant coming in from Mexico.
So these walls that he envisions, he even said at one point that former President Obama had surrounded his house with a 10-foot wall, which was not true at
right.
all. But what he did say was walls work. Do we need walls to satisfy the evangelicals, or is it more than that wall?
Well, it's really complex. I think walls work as political messaging, is what I would say, less than they do as policy. And what's notable is that so white evangelical support for the wall has actually gone up in the last 2 years. So even at his election, there were already 58% of white evangelicals supporting this idea of a wall on the southern border. But in our last survey around the midterms, that number jumped up to 67. So it's almost 10 percentage points that it's gone up just in the last 2 years. So it works, I think, as a political messaging point, as a rallying cry against broader things like cultural change you're uncomfortable with, demographic change you're uncomfortable with, religious change you're uncomfortable with. It works as a sort of bulwark against those things, but not so much on the ground as policy.
But surely there must be religious evangelicals working within the government who are affected by this shutdown.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you get to actual policy, you know, we'll see, because what's notable about white evangelical Protestants if Trump shifted to policy, let's say, and he wanted to talk about DACA, what's interesting about that is that half of white evangelicals actually support
DACA.
If he wanted to talk about a path to citizenship for immigrants who are in the country illegally, half of white evangelicals actually support a path to citizenship for those in the country illegally. And they oppose the family separation policies that his administration, 56% of them oppose this practice of separating children from their parents at the border. So his job gets much more complicated if he shifts to policy. But on this more symbolic thing that's about fear, anxiety, broad cultural change, you know, he has a sort of symbolic winner, even while these policies are more complicated.
It really is bewildering that the feelings beneath all this are so complex. Writer Michael Gerson wrote in the Washington Post recently saying that for some evangelicals, it is nothing less than the end times conflict of good and evil, which somehow culminated in fights against the Obama administration. He's willing to use hardball tactics in their battle with the Philistines. Evangelicals have essentially hired their own Goliath, brutal, pagan, but on their side. How do you react?
You know, I think there's good evidence that this is the way that many evangelicals are interpreting Trump's presidency. So what's notable at the beginning of his presidency, there were a lot of theories being floated about how evangelicals could justify support for President Trump. And they range from the kind of instrumental
behavior.
Given his behavior. And so they range from kind of very instrumental things like this that, okay, look, whether he's one of us or not is beside the point. What's important is whether he is going to work for our agenda or do things that are important. And there's kind of a way you can map certain biblical stories onto that as a way of justifying it. So I think that's one thing we've seen. Notably, one of the things we saw seen dropping from public discussion was an original assertion that Trump himself actually had converted and become an evangelical Christian, and he was called a baby Christian. That was the way of kind of excusing some of the behavior that he hadn't quite matured as a Christian, but we would see him doing that over the course of his presidency. Now, of course, Trump has been Trump from day one, and it's been notable, I think, as I've been observing, that evangelical leaders aren't floating that theory anymore.
Now, tell me about the column that Catherine Stewart wrote referring to King Cyrus. Explain this.
There's a number of stories in the biblical text that I can't work here, but King Cyrus, what the basic idea is that he's a pagan king, sort of who God raises up on behalf of the Israelites. So they don't have to claim that he's one of them, that he's even consciously acting on their behalf is not important. What's important is that he, in fact, is doing it, and maybe even he doesn't even know that he's being the instrument of God at the end of the day, is the way that story runs. And that story gets mapped onto President Trump. So it doesn't matter whether Trump is consciously really even doing anything on behalf of evangelicals. But if God has raised a person like this up for this particular time, and it's notable that these things happen in desperate times, these kinds of stories where God raises up some unusual person, maybe even someone who's antithetical to values that you might want to put out. In desperate times, there are calls for desperate measures. And in many ways, I think this is what we see. We asked a question close to this in a survey where we asked respondents whether they agreed or disagreed with the statement that because times were so bad, we needed a strong leader who was willing to break the rules if that's what it takes to set things right. And white evangelicals strongly support that statement, much more strongly than the general population.
The idea that we need a king rather than a president?
Yeah, if you take it out to its logical conclusion, I mean, that's what it maps out to, a kind of authoritarian leader who might be able to work outside of political norms, even legal norms, because the end is so important. And that, I think, is something we've also seen that, you know, if we go back to the values voters idea, that was a very principled-based political ethic, right? If you took it seriously, if you were a values voter, you would say, here are my values. I'm going to measure every political candidate according to these values, and I'm going to let the chips fall where they may. But what we've seen with the rise of President Trump is a very different political ethic that's more like a utilitarian or ends justify the means ethic, that instead of principles determining where you end up, you have an end goal, and that end goal is so important that you can then adjust the means any way you want, right, to justify that end. But that's antithetical to the very logic, the kind of moral logic of a values voter.
And that's what's so confusing to all of us.
Yeah, and you can see it in the data, too. We asked the question in 2011 about whether a political leader could commit an immoral act in their private life and still behave ethically in their public life. Only 30% of evangelicals agreed with this when we first asked the question in 2011. We asked it again in the fall of 2016 with Trump at the top of the ticket, and that number had gone from 30% to 72% of white evangelicals saying that a leader could commit an immoral act in their private life and still behave ethically in their public life. So it's clearly Trump at the top of the ticket, political ethics get turned on its head.
And now, a quick break. When we come back, more from Robert P. Jones.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Robert P. Jones, author of The End of White Christian America. So we are now in a brand new situation. I was reading the editorial this morning in the New York Times about the treatment of women around the country in terms of right to life, in terms of abortion, in terms of just health, mental health. I mean, the laws are changing, and I wonder how much of that is pushed by the notion that you have such a strong base of support for this president.
You know, it is a strong base of support, but what's interesting about it, again, is that there's this gap between how influential in the culture and in the general population this base group of white evangelicals is and how influential they are at the ballot box, right? Because they're only 15% of Americans today, and that's new. I mean, even 10 years ago, they were 21%, right? So this is new that they make up this smaller amount of the country, and yet they're a quarter of voters, right? So it means that there's this kind of interesting gap between the culture and the electorate that we're living through. And I think that's why we sometimes are seeing this kind of seesawing in our politics, where some states are moving this direction, some other states are moving that direction. The federal and the state level policies tend to be kind of at odds, depending on what states we're talking about. We're in this kind of liminal space because we're at a tipping point of demographic and cultural change in the country. And, you know, our best estimates look like it'll be 2024 before the cultural realities that are here today fully express themselves at the ballot box.
Say a little more about that.
One of the things that I think white evangelicals have going for them in terms of political power is, despite their waning numbers, they turn out at very high rates.
Okay.
And they turn out at higher rates than other Americans do. So, for example, in the exit polls, you know, we have them at 15% of the population. They are 26% of voters. So they're 11 percentage points overrepresented at the ballot box. And it's just because of this differential turnout rate that they're able to have more electoral power than they actually have in the population. In our country, the ballot box acts like a time machine that takes us back about 10 years, demographically speaking. So it takes us about 10 years to catch up at the ballot box compared to where we are at a particular point in history in terms of our actual population.
So give me an example of a kind of idea or strongly held belief that will show up in the ballot box 10 years from now.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the bookends of our kind of religious landscape are white evangelical Protestants that tend to be older, they're white, non-Hispanic, obviously, and tend to be Republican, vote fairly conservatively. And the religiously unaffiliated, on the other hand, that tend to be younger, much more demographically diverse. And as that group begins to express itself more, for example, they only make up about 12% of voters, even though they're a quarter of the population. So the opposite effect is in play there. So as these begin to equalize, you know, we're going to see more solid support for immigration, for sure. So things like the wall, these will not be things, you know, that'll have broad support. It doesn't have broad support today. Only about 4 in 10 Americans support the wall on the southern border today. But that number will surely drop over time. More support for LGBT rights, more support for women's reproductive health and rights, for protecting those rights. That culture shift is already underway and is going to kind of accelerate as we move forward.
Which may make the evangelicals that much more uncomfortable now.
That's right. I think one of the things that I think is sometimes missed on the left is the sense of anxiety, vertigo, fear, as white evangelicals in particular see the sun setting on this world that they've grown up in and really thought that they mostly owned. And I think sort of this sense of having to find their seat at the table with other people on equal terms rather than sort of owning the table is one of the things that I think is driving the sense of anxiety and fear among white evangelicals.
So the wall represents a symbolic barrier for them. Not so much, or in addition to keeping people out, it's also keeping our ideas and ideals in for evangelicals.
I think that's right. The wall serves for white evangelicals both as a physical barrier and, you know, a literal kind of wall. But I think more importantly, it's symbolic. It's a metaphor. And it's even temporal. Right. So it's not even just in geographic space. It's in temporal space. It's about holding on to a previous version of America and kind of holding back some of the changes that they see at the gates. I mean, it really is the barbarians at the gates, you know, metaphor that is operative here. And it fits with a kind of worldview that's kind of binary in many ways. Right. It's black and white morality. It's male and female gender hierarchies. It is a sort of set of chosen insiders against kind of dangerous outsiders. There are lots of binaries, and walls work really well in those kinds of worldviews.
So, Robby, if you were to take a survey today on how evangelicals feel about a government shutdown and people not receiving salaries, people not being able to pay their bills, feed their families, what kinds of reactions do you think you'd get?
Well, I don't have numbers on that right in front of me. But what I would say is that evangelicals are interesting on this point, that there is a kind of pragmatism, though, that comes along with all this kind of fear here that I mentioned before, that if you get down to policies and you're actually acting about policies, despite all the fear, there is a kind of pragmatism that runs through evangelicals. So I think to the extent that a government shutdown is something they will feel, it will matter more. Now, the challenge is that the evangelicals are concentrated in the southern states, so it'll have to be things that really impact southern states and not just big cities. So things trickle down. So, for example, if airports start shutting down because TSA personnel aren't working, you know, if the Atlanta, Georgia airport shuts down because of that's something evangelicals will certainly feel. Atlanta, Dallas, you know, Birmingham, these hubs in the South, Charlotte, that's, I think, one avenue through. Or tax refunds not showing up in people's mailboxes. There really is tangible and physical to make a shift here, given their support for the president and their support for this idea.
So you're saying that they would not necessarily feel empathy for the individuals who may not be able to put food on the table?
You know, I think as long as it's a news story, it's going to be pretty difficult because I think they're fairly – white evangelicals are fairly dug in support for the president. You know, they're really ready to rally around the president. I've even talked about this as, you know, kind of building a wall of their own, of protection around the president when he's embattled. So insofar as President Trump looks like someone who's standing up for things they're worried about, my best judgment is they'll probably stand behind him until it really starts hitting them very, very close to home.
Okay, so now let's look at the Congress and what you see happening there. Thus far, we've seen two Republicans sort of indicate, well, maybe we really ought to rethink this, go a little more slowly. How likely is that Republican support for this wall and the shutdown of the government going to continue?
Well, I think that's what it's going to take. I would not hold my breath for a grassroots Republican uprising putting pressure on President Trump. But to the extent that there are lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, who in their own districts have government employees at high levels, I think there we'll see some pressure. Whether it'll be enough at the end of the day, you know, to push things along, I'm not sure.
Any predictions on your part as to how long this might last?
Yeah. Well, I think the trouble is that President Trump has never been committed to the well-being of the Republican Party. So if we had a president that was really concerned about protecting the party, I think we'd be looking at much shorter time here. But, you know, I think President Trump is looking at 2020, his own election, not so much the immediate consequences that are happening on the ground. And you know, it's unclear to me, at least, what's going to have enough leverage on him to get him to kind of back down. And he's just doubled down and doubled down, and he's kind of boxed in at this point. Even fencing, I think, would be hard for him to kind of sell to his supporters at this point as a win in this negotiation.
Boxed in by so few television commentators, radio hosts, that's a kind of power that apparently is supported by these evangelicals, is it not?
You know, that's right. And when we asked on surveys where people get their news from,
yeah,
we have nearly half of white evangelicals saying they primarily trust Fox News to give them the most accurate information about current affairs. So we have a kind of closed circle almost. And for many people who are hearing President Trump, who are hearing Sean Hannity, who it's just a kind of, you know, vicious circle. And most of the people that they're talking to are looking at those same two sources of input. You know, that's a reality that we're dealing with. The other thing that perhaps why this may has enough leverage on Trump himself is, you know, he's built his, you know, reputation around buildings. Right. And so the idea of building something that's concrete, literally concrete, or at least physically apparent, right, where, you know, you could put a plaque on it, right, that says like this wall erected under the President Trump's administration between these dates, and it would sit there forever, almost a monument, right, to Trump and his policies and his successes. I can't think that's very far from Trump's mind on this as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. You may have noticed we had some new theme music. It's by Jim Rundberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Natalie Urib-Lipker. Thanks for listening. Happy New Year. We'll be back with you again on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.